coming up.
I sent people checks, and instead of being like, thank you very much, Mr. Trump, or Trump did a good job, everyone said, who got it, who got it, who got it? And you make me look very bad.
Is the philanthropy of the rich a substitute for democratically controlled government action?
Isn't the society in which literature and the arts need to depend on philanthropy a sick one?
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Why should we let the rich decide our social priorities?
Isn't it a disgrace to die wealthy?
I don't want your charity. I want your tax dollars.
Our guest is Bruce Sievers from the Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society at Stanford.
I'd be rich.
The Philanthropy Trap.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Bonjour, I'm John Perry, coming to you today from Paris, the City of Lights. I'm here giving some lectures about philosophy at the Institut Jean Nicole.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and I'm stuck back here stateside, but in the lovely studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for about 40 years.
Now you're off globe-trotting, John. And today, we're thinking about the philanthropy trap.
People tend to think of philanthropy as an absolute good, but there's a downside that they seldom pay attention to.
Oh, come on. Downside? What downside could there possibly be to people voluntarily giving to charitable causes? Surely, that's something we ought to encourage, something we need more of, not less of.
Well, when the giving comes from the ultra-wealthy fat cats like Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg, they're getting tax savings in exchange for the right to set up huge foundations that decide what's important and what's not important.
What would you prefer that they do with their money, John? Spend it on fast cars and fancy yachts and meals in the on the Seine or something?
Oh, well, contributions to philosophy talk wouldn't be a bad idea. But anyway, why do the super wealthy get to decide what the world needs? How did they become experts on the public good?
Well, John, I get your point, but like it or not, we're in a capitalist society. Great inequalities of wealth. Money equals power. And when you've got money, you can influence all sorts of things that regular Joe Smoes like you and me can't. That's kind of the way the world works, and philanthropy helps us to make the best of a bad world.
Yeah, but what you're describing is fundamentally undemocratic. The wealthy should not have a greater say in what counts as the public good or how the public policy is shaped than anyone else.
You know, it may not be democratic, but given capitalism and given these great inequalities of wealth, I still want you to answer my question. Given that there are people who are super rich and we're not going to be able to make them unsuper rich, isn't it better that they donate some of their wealth rather than spend it all selfishly on themselves and their families?
Oh, don't roll over and play dead. I reject your binary choice. We can do some things. We can make it better. There are other possibilities, you know.
Well, enlighten me, oh wise one.
Well, how about these great tax breaks? These foundations and gifts are tax exempt. That means we pay more taxes or we get less services than we would if those guys paid taxes on these things. If they actually tax the super wealthy more, we could use that money to do good in the world as decided by the Democratic majority or the small d, you know, the people. Instead of the 1% dictating what counts as the public good, it would be decided in a democratic way by all of us.
Well, yeah, right. We the people. We have so much power in deciding how our taxes are actually spent. Come on, John. You're living in a dream world.
Well, we've got a representative democracy. It's not perfect, but taxing the rich and pooling their money to tackle major social problems is surely a better alternative than simply letting the 1% decide what's important and what's not.
Come on, I'm going to give you a real choice. Do you really think the world would be better without any charitable organizations? I mean, come on, where would we be without the Gates Foundation or the Clinton Global Initiative? They're actually doing great work in the world. They're tackling problems that governments don't seem to have the will to tackle.
Well, you say governments don't have the will to tackle these problems? So they certainly often lack the money, and their efforts are obstructed at every turn by right-wing ideologues who think that if the market doesn't provide social goods, government has no business doing it either.
Well, look, I'm going to grant you that the state certainly has a legitimate role in providing social goods. But unfortunately, you know, the state's not always the most efficient actor. I mean, governments can be mired in bureaucracy. They can be slow to adapt and change. And so instead of just leaving it to the market, I don't want to leave everything to the market. Instead of just leaving it to the market forces to tackle social problems, we need what's called civil society. And that's a lot of participation by successful entrepreneurs and other committed people. And it's not just their money that we need, but it's their innovative ideas, too.
Innovative ideas. That's the Silicon Valley trademark. So we're going to have an app to solve homelessness. You're drinking the Kool-Aid.
Come on, John. That's just a caricature of the tech industry. And it doesn't say anything about real philanthropy. You got to judge philanthropic efforts on a case-by-case basis. And you can't just dismiss the entire enterprise in one fell swoop.
Okay. So since we can't dismiss the whole enterprise, we sent our roving philosophical reporter out, Shuka Kalantari, a roving philosophical reporter, out to find out if something called indie philanthropy might be a step in the right direction. She files this report.
The word philosophy means love of knowledge. The word philanthropy means love of people. But today, philanthropy has come to mean giving away a lot of money to people. Philanthropic groups in the U.S. donated over $60 billion in 2015 alone. But not everybody is happy about that.
I actually am very hesitant about the word philanthropist.
Neda Nobari is herself a philanthropist.
I think there is this image of entitlement.
But Nobari says that's not her game. Once a high-ranking exec in the fashion world, she started the Neda Nobari Foundation to advocate for social and environmental justice. But her foundation does it a little differently. Most philanthropists pick a main pet cause and stick with it. The Susan G. Komen Foundation focuses on breast cancer. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation takes on public education. But Nobari focuses on everything from climate change to documentary film.
We call it indie philanthropy because in a sort of textbook philanthropic education, the ABC, they tell you not to be spread so thin and have so many focus areas.
But Nobari says life doesn't come in compartments. Society is interconnected. One thing always leads to another.
So, for example, climate change, environmental challenges that we're facing, will be the number one cause of migration and refugees around the world in this century.
Climate change leads to mass migration. Mass migration leads to refugees without resources. Lots of poor immigrants leads to xenophobia.
So how can I pick one topic and say, we're just going to do environmental causes and not pay attention to the other factors that can address the challenges around social justice issues?
Nobari's indie philanthropy group is like traditional foundations in one way. They get a big tax break.
In a true democracy and in an ideal situation, people would pay their fair share of taxes, and those taxes would be able to provide the social programs.
Programs like free healthcare for all and free higher education. But Nobari insists we don't have a true democracy.
A lot of our tax money goes to the military and doesn't leave much room for support for these type of programs. So that's where philanthropy fills the gap.
Nobari's philanthropy has ranged from fighting deforestation in Brazil to supporting an indie film about Afghanistan's first rock band coming to America.
When you think about an Afghani, you don't visualize a rock band. I think most people visualize a photo of some girl who has had acid sprayed on her face. The story offers a different image.
Neda Nobari says in an ideal world, there wouldn't be a need for philanthropy. But we don't live in an ideal world. We live in a capitalistic society. We're driven by profit. Nobari says as long as our government continues to reduce budgets for education, healthcare, and other social services, philanthropists like her will be there to pick up the slack and fill in the gaps. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
I'm John Perry in Paris. Shuka, thanks for that interesting report about nouveau philanthropy. Back in San Francisco, we're joined by my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about the philanthropy trap. We're joined now by Bruce Sievers. He's co-founder of the Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society. He's also a visiting scholar at the Haas Center for Public Service and author of Civil Society, Philanthropy, and the Fate of the Commons. Bruce, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, Bruce, philanthropy is clearly important in societies like ours where philanthropists make some big decisions that have big impact. And anything about money is kind of interesting. But do you really find philanthropy intriguing? Or maybe I should say, what about philanthropy made you find it so interesting to really get involved in the way you have?
Well, I got involved, became into philanthropy kind of accidentally. I had just finished a PhD and was debating whether to go into academic work, or and along came this opportunity to connect with an organization that related humanities to public policy through grants. But once I entered the field and began to get more involved, I then became an executive director of an actual private foundation, and became more and more intrigued as I got into the field about the issues that are there. So I became more interested in the philosophical questions once I got involved.
Well, now, in our opening, Ken and I had a disagreement about whether philanthropy was overall a good thing or not. The view I represented, it said, it's a fundamentally undemocratic idea and has no place in the ideal state. Where Ken presented, I guess, a more practical point of view, a lot of good comes from rich entrepreneurs influencing how we tackle social problems. So, what's your position?
Well, despite the fact that I understand the objections and I share some of the critiques, I think on balance, I'm certainly with Ken in the sense of even in an ideal world, you'd want philanthropy.
Yeah, that's something that intrigues me, because Shuka mentioned, the person in Shuka's mentions, in an ideal society, we might not need this. I mean, is philanthropy, on your view, something that takes up the slack where the state fails? Or is it something that even if the state were doing everything it was supposed to do and the market was doing everything it was supposed to do, we'd still need this third thing, this civil society and philanthropy and all that?
Well, one of my favorite philosophers is Michael Walzer, and he wrote a wonderful essay called Socialism and the Gift Relationship. And in it, he asked, even in the good socialist society, would you want philanthropy? And most socialists would say no. And he says yes, and he says yes for a couple of reasons. One is that philanthropy does supplement and provide services that even the best state can't provide. And secondly, it encourages a norm, a value of generosity, which is, as he suggests, and I agree, is an extremely important norm to have society accept.
When we think about philanthropy, American philanthropy in the 20th and 21st century has this peculiar shape to it. That is, when Senator Stanford gave Stanford to the Children of California, he didn't get a tax break. I mean, I don't see how he could have, because the income tax hadn't been invented. So who could complain about that? I mean, maybe you shouldn't have really rich people with really big ranches, but if you do, who can complain about them doing nice things? But how about all this tax stuff that comes into it? Should we really be giving tax breaks for this? Is it required? Is it really philanthropy if you get a tax break?
Well, it is true that there is a benefit, and that Stanford gave the money before the income tax was established, so that didn't apply. And yet, what we are suggesting is that it's society's modest encouragement of this arena of activity that in civil society that really is vitally important as a complement to both the market and government. And the fundamental way that gets supported is through philanthropy. So yes, I would say even encouraging through the modest tax breaks and tax encouragement that is provided, it's two-thirds or more of the money that goes into the field still is beyond what would otherwise be recovered in taxes. So you're getting a two for one in many ways.
We'll have to take this up. I mean, I have some real questions about that because it makes it takes it out of the sphere of pure altruism and puts it into the sphere of sort of self-interested calculation in a way. And that's a little tricky, but we'll have to dig into these things. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the philanthropy trap.
Yes, and I'm thinking about it so hard here in Paris, I lost my place. So I'll just let Ken say what comes
Can
next.
Can justice be served when the 1% have so much influence over public policy? Is philanthropy fundamentally undemocratic? Shouldn't we just tax the rich instead? Philanthropy, justice, and democracy, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
We all give a little bit to our favorite causes, at least most of us do, but some people give a lot to things that we might have expected our government would take care of. Is that a good thing? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about the philanthropy trap.
Our guest is Bruce Sievers from Stanford. He's the author of Civil Society, Philanthropy, and the Fate of the Commons.
So, Bruce, I think philanthropy is a good thing, but I got to admit that I do have worries. One of the worries is that philanthropy amplifies the voices of the rich and powerful, and it turns over to them, it delegates to them the decision as to what counts as a public good worth funding and to what degree, rather than being those kind of questions being decided in a democratic way. I know you like philanthropy. I know you think even in an ideal society there would still be philanthropy. But does this kind of thing worry you at all?
Sure. I think that is the Achilles heel of the field, that there's a danger that private wealth that controls a lot in society anyway also gets extended into the social sphere. But I'd have two questions. One is, what is the alternative? The alternative seems to be a more kind of confiscatory tax policy, which has its own problems. And the other piece is that it isn't as if there's one single point of view being championed by a single philanthropist. It's an incredibly diverse field, even among the wealthy, which have very different agendas. And by the way, more than 85% of the money that's contributed every year, which actually is around $350 billion these days, 85% of that is contributed by individuals in smaller amounts. So it isn't that just huge donations
right.
are making.
Right, but I'm not quite sure. Okay, so you said that it's a worry, but how do we live with the downside of amplifying the voices of those who give? I mean, you're sure there are competing agendas, right? So what decides which agenda wins out? We in the state, we have elections, we have recall and all this stuff. We have these deliberative procedures. Right. Some philanthropist says, I'm going to decide that X deserves $100 billion more dollars. I mean,
well, if you think that the outcome of the democratic process right now is the ideal way to support social activities, I think I'd say that's a mistake. I think there's a reason for having both modes. One is a majoritarian decision. The other one is this pluralism.
Rob in Richmond, I think you have a point on this.
Yeah. Your guest gave it away when he said confiscatory. I'm sorry. It's probably a libertarian sensibility. There's a communitarian sensibility here, too. These rich people have no constituency, even less than the Sun King. They could get up in the morning and with massive amounts of social resources, and they are social resources, say, I'm going to have lunch, or maybe I'll buy Norway, or arm South Dakota to secede from the U.S. No one would say anything to them. And they can do that. And the problem here is the social resources have no constituencies save that one person. And that's anti-democratic. It's anti-communitarian. And you could do philanthropy on the, let's say piece it out and have your, whatever structure. But the way we've set it up in this society, we're saying, oh, society isn't working. therefore we have to have our saviors.
Yeah, so Rob.
And so wait a minute.
Yeah, Rob, thanks for the call. It's a well taken point, and I'm going to give Bruce a chance to respond. What do you want to respond to?
Sure. There is always this danger of plutocracy and the power of wealth. All I'm suggesting is that, again, there's a variety of points of view that are expressed in the field, worrying about climate change, worrying about kids and growing up and without adequate health care and so forth. And all of those needs are in one way or another being addressed. And then I'd also go back to the other point of view, which is that apart from the 15% that is allocated through foundations, 85% of the money that is given in a very dispersed way by individual gifts throughout society. So it isn't just a question of a few very rich people giving all the money. The money it comes from a huge range of sources.
So I think it sounds to me like there's a kind of defense of pluralism kind of thing behind your point of view. And I want to ask you, because I reading your book, it seems to me pretty clear that you're a big fan of what people call civil society.
Right.
On the one hand, there's the market, which is private, purely driven by private self-interest.
Right.
On the other hand, there's the state, which hopefully a democratic state, which is driven by deliberation and collective decision-making of some kind. And then there's in between that, between the market and the state, there's this other sphere, the civil society, which is an arena in which citizens freely associate, freely act, pursue a variety of goods. And you seem to think that the civil society is actually, the thriving of civil society beyond the market and beyond government is like really important to a well-functioning state.
Absolutely. For one reason, it can think potentially in longer terms and does, for instance, future generations. In the market, it's worried about the next quarterly return. In government, it's worried about the next election. And so both government and the market are almost inevitably short-sighted, whereas in civil society, there's an opportunity, and it's taken, to look at the longer view.
So, I mean, I was thinking that, I don't know what you or John think about that, I was thinking that one response to Rob, from your point of view, might be, well, yeah, there's a downside to letting the civil society, because of the pluralism of civil society, some things are going to be pursued within civil society that I might not approve of.
That's
and that might not win the election. But letting a multiplicity of projects be pursued within civil society, not through the market and not with the coercive arm of the government, is a good thing for a flourishing society.
Absolutely. I think pluralism is the strong point of philanthropy and of civil society in general. And as I say, civil society depends in part, significant part, on philanthropy to survive, because your other two sources of support for civil society are what? Their earned income, which is like a market. The more you have to rely on earned income, the more you end up looking like a market or organization. Or you can rely on government support, and the more you rely on government support, the more you become looking like government.
So, John, I wonder what you think about this, because you were arguing,
Well, let me go back to something Rob said. Yeah, I think he mentioned arming the militia in South Dakota. This year I've spent a lot of money supporting actually two candidates and some local candidates. I give money to both Hillary and to Bernie because I like them both. None of that is tax deductible. So there are limits on our encouraging giving through tax deductions. But I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about how extensive those limits are. I mean, for example, when Bloomberg gives a lot to advocate gun control, is that deductible? Are contributions to the NRA deductible? Do we have any conception of what's appropriate, inappropriate, aside from political campaigns?
Yeah, that's one of the most difficult arenas, is where how that line gets drawn. But there are specific legal limits. For instance, you cannot support a political campaign straight out through a tax-deductible donation. That's illegal. You may remember a year or so ago that there was this huge question with the IRS about whether they were anointing particular entities to be tax-deductible or not, based on political orientation. So there's real limits in terms of what can be done in terms of the political side of this. But Bloomberg can, for instance, support organizations that educate about problems of guns and violence, just in the same way that people can support organizations that may be pro, you know,
Second guns Amendment and violence. And so yeah.
Pro Second Amendment, I guess we'd say. But if you get into advocating in a political campaign, that's off limits.
William in Belvedere, welcome to Philosophy Talk, William. What's your comment or question?
Yes, thank you very much. This is sort of a variation on what President Obama said in a campaign when he was saying that to wealthy people, oh, you think you did that yourself. If you didn't have that highway to take your goods on, what do you think you'd be able to do? I'd like to just, in that connection, for instance, patents. Society as a whole grants to individuals patents. Patents allow the individual to have a benefit in the sense that they can be the sole producers of the item for an extended period of time. I'd appreciate your views and the guest views on whether the fact that society grants, in a sense, increased income to that individual by the patent system doesn't impart to that individual an obligation to pay back society for that exclusion that person gets for that period of time.
So, William, let me see if I get the thrust of the question. I'm going to try and rephrase it and see if you agree with the rephrasing. So you want to argue that a kind of charitable giving... Charity sounds like a discretionary thing.
Right.
It's up to you. You want to say, no, since we empowered you to make... in ways that enabled you to be wealthy, you owe us. It's not just charity. It's a kind of obligation. Philanthropy is a kind of obligation. I think some rich people actually feel that, Bruce. What do you think?
Sure. I mean, I think clearly there is a sort of, we're all beneficiaries of the social investment that the rest of society has made and that our predecessors have made. But I just think that there is an arena that's there where there's room for voluntary action over and above what is mandated or expected by the government in return. I think example is we get tax credits for solar panels on our houses. That doesn't mean the government owns the solar panels. It means that that society has made a decision to encourage a certain kind of behavior.
Yeah, but I'm thinking, though, I would take William's question in a different way. I would think from the point of the view of the state empowering philanthropy,
right.
It's like, I'm going to power the free association, the liberty and pluralism of the citizens, but the ethos of the citizen should be, okay, given that structure and given the social benefits I see, I now owe it, not as a legal obligation, but
sure.
I now owe it to society at large.
Absolutely. I think the adoption of a voluntary norm is absolutely right, that one should feel that obligation. The question is how much actual regulation should accompany that.
Right.
And that's where I would...
John, you got any wisdom you want to add here from Paris?
any wisdom I want to add? Well, I have a question. Back in the Eisenhower era, I had some interest in taxes and stuff because I was kind of a little teenage libertarian then. The tax on the highest level of wealth was very high, above 90%, I believe.
Right.
And now I think that tax is below 40%. So you might say, well, if taxes were that high, people wouldn't be so rich, wouldn't have so much to contribute. On the other hand, if taxes are that high, every dollar they get that's exempt them from taxes is all that much greater. Do we have any studies, as the groups you work with done studies about how the lessening of the highest tax rate over the last 50 years has affected philanthropy?
Yeah, I'm not sure about there have been studies that show that definitely as taxes go up, there is a greater incentive to give because it's clearly you get a higher tax benefit through that process. But I haven't seen anything that specifically addresses the question that you ask, which is the tax rate has gone down. Has that, in fact, made a big difference in philanthropy, and I think that would be a really difficult one.
But there's a prior question. Is most philanthropic giving actually driven by tax considerations, which sounds like naked self-interest, right, as it were? Right. Sounds like the market, a version of the market consideration. Or is it given by pure altruism and pure generosity?
Not pure. I don't think either side is pure. There's always a question, even in terms of psychological satisfaction, you could say, of self-interest in giving. You get your name on a building, whatever it happens to be. But it's always a blend, I think.
Yeah, but see, that's why some people, say, on the left really object to this, because it's like stroking the egos. I mean, I have a colleague and a friend who's also, I think, a friend and colleague of yours, is that, you know, why should you give millions of dollars? Why should you get a tax break for giving millions of dollars to Stanford University, our joint employer, right, when Stanford University basically benefits the upper crust, right? Why should you get a tax break for doing that? Oh, because you get a... I mean, if it's just to salve your ego and to see things done that you want to do, well, do it, but why do you get...
Well, I would argue with the premise that Stanford just benefits the upper crust. I mean, the fact is, first of all, there's this huge amount of scholarships at Stanford to support a whole range of students that are there, but also the benefits of the university itself and the universities in general. I think an enormous amount of social good has come out of the research, out of the teaching and so forth that these institutions have provided. And the fact that that's been enhanced by a lot of selfless giving and some sort of self-oriented giving, it's been that blend that has been the resource that these institutions have depended on.
Let me quickly point out that when Senator Stanford started the place and Mrs. Stanford, no tuition was charged until the 30s. So
yeah,
it was
but
for everyone.
It wasn't as, yeah, it's not that cheap anymore. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about the philanthropy trap with Bruce Sievers from the Haas Center for Public Service at Stanford University.
How do we reap the benefits of philanthropic giving and also make sure that the wealthy don't have too much power to shape and influence our society?
Philanthropy versus social engineering, when Philosophy Talk continues.
So give it away, just like the Red Hot Chili Peppers tell you to. And if you give enough away, you get a huge tax break. But how about the rest of us? Do we get to vote on where you should give it or how big your tax break should be? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Bruce Sievers, author of Civil Society, Philanthropy, and the Fate of the Commons. And we're thinking about the philanthropy trap. And we've got a caller on the line, Irene from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Irene. What's your comment or question?
Hi. So I had one point that I was going to make when I started calling, but...
Once
I've listened to your conversation, it reminded me that, I mean, I have artist friends who don't qualify as nonprofits, and I give them money every now and then as a middle class, you know, friend. Like, that's the kind of society we should just be having, is everybody has a contribution, a special nature, and our whole education system and economic system should be about finding that contribution they should make, right?
Yeah, I think you're agreeing with Bruce on something. I would put your point this way to get it into our theory, background of theory. You're saying that civil society, relations between person and person, unmediated by the structures of government, just and associations and friendship, and that's a really important thing. And we can't just think about pure market. You don't give to your artist friend out of a market consideration or pure government. Without a civil society, we can't really live together. What do you think about that, Bruce?
Well, absolutely. And don't forget the voluntary time. I mean, that the time that's contributed is almost as much as the value of the dollars that are contributed every year. And that time is contributed by lots of individuals in many, many ways. So there's a huge range of ways that people can contribute. And I just go back to this idea of which has been described by Robert Putnam, the author of Bowling Alone, as the ideal of generalized reciprocity, which basically means encouraging broad sense of generosity as a way of mutual help in society. And I think that is a hugely important norm.
I worry. Go ahead, John. Sorry.
Yeah. So there's something that was said about Donald Trump, and I don't want to get political here, but I don't know whether it was President Obama that said it or I don't know, somebody on TV. He said he's like a guy that wakes up on third base and assumes he must have hit a triple. Now, one has a sense that a lot of really rich people are not like that. I don't think Warren Buffett is like that. For the one place he didn't wake up on third base, right. And he did hit a triple. But should there be some objective measure that tells people, given their particular entrepreneurial bent and their source of wealth and so forth, how much they really depend and should be grateful to the particular American institutions like the interstate and the stable, relatively stable dollar that made this possible? Would that be a good idea?
Well, sure. Buffett himself says, how would he do if he had grown up in Africa or something? I mean, he attributes his own wealth to the enormous benefits of society that he's grown up in. But I think that's a given, and that ought to be encouraged in people's thinking universally. But I don't think that relates very much to the question of whether what kind of norm he has when he thinks about giving things back to society.
But one of the things, if I were a Peter Singer-type utilitarian, mm-hmm. I would think, well, hardly any of us are doing enough. And if we leave it to sort of voluntary decision-making, purely voluntary decision-making, so Buffett gives some significant percentage of his wealth. Gates gives some significant, but they still live really high on the hog when the world is filled with suffering, and most of us give almost no percentage of our wealth. And we Westerners, Singer would say, have an obligation, a moral obligation, to give much, 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 much more than we do. Not to be too hard on the philanthropist, but you know. We shouldn't overpraise them.
Warren Buffett lives in Omaha. He and I grew up in Nebraska. Warren, as I like to call him. I've never met him. But, he lives in a relatively modest house in Omaha and has Diet Coke and Cheetos for breakfast every morning. So he's not really an excessively obscene consumer.
No, I mean, two things here. One is the sort of the operation of capitalist society and the tax structure. And I think that's a kind of important issue that needs to be debated. But I think it's somewhat separate from this idea of a norm of giving and giving back to society. I think there is a It's not just that there's excess wealth out there. It's that there are important things that can be done through this means of voluntary giving.
Yeah, yeah.
The alternative, one is just to go spend it on yachts. The other one is if you, for instance, were to tax it or eliminate the tax deduction, so what do you want, another B-1 bomber as a replacement?
The Saeed in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Saeed.
Yeah, it's the voluntary contribution or, altruism or taxes, the two things to keep them separate. Taxes is for the community, for the, whereas individuals can be voluntarily give as much but not get a tax break. Taxes should be used by the government to direct some direction, like solar panels you were mentioning earlier, whereas if I want my purpose to be fulfilled and I want to give money, it should not be tax deductible. I will get what I want from what I contribute, but not have a tax break because that changes the whole.
Yeah, good. Nature. I got your point, Saeed. So, what do you think, Bruce?
But what's wrong with government encouraging in a modest way that sort of behavior. I mean, again, just like solar panels, government is encouraging all kinds of things. And in this case, it's a pluralistic supply of social goods.
Right. So, I mean, so the government sometimes tries to supplement the activity of the market or regulate the activity of the market. Right, by providing goods or subsidies for goods, on buying them on the market, right, or establish markets. That's a good thing for the government to do. But civil society, which is distinct from the market, is another thing. I mean, you kind of convinced me that civil society is another thing that the government should not just take note of and be indifferent to, but should say, hey, I will do my part to make sure that civil society is well-functioning and thriving.
Should actively encourage. And it's, again, it's the encouragement of the distributed, pluralistic supply of social goods, of common goods. It's just another way of doing it. Instead of trying to make it a process that is decided by, say, 51% of the electorate, which basically is what government goods are done by. Instead, it's suggesting there's a whole range of kinds of things that have to do with public benefit that can be supplied in a very pluralistic way.
So, John, since I can't look you in the eye, and so what do you want to add to that? You want to add something?
Well, you know, the view I took in the introduction was a little bit extreme, and it seems to me it's worth mentioning that there's a lot of things, some of which I don't care too much about, like opera, and other things I do care quite a bit about, like private universities and certain kinds of art and so forth and so on, that are never going to get the approval of Congress for government to spend money on them. Certain kinds of art are very controversial, for example. So I do think philanthropy, on balance, I mean, whenever you discuss whether something's good, there's always a given, you know. Are we talking about the ideal state?
Right.
What's the point of that? You know, maybe ideally there wouldn't be any big tall mountains we couldn't climb, but there are. So what do we do with it?
You got a quick
response? So the system we have, it seems to actually play a pretty good role, in my humble opinion.
You got a quick response?
No, I would just agree. I mean, I think it's a balancing act for sure. You need to have some kind of oversight and feedback process, and I think that's, again, an Achilles heel of the field, that it lacks, especially the large foundations, a true negative feedback process, which it needs. But I think fundamentally the social purposes that it benefits, it's done in a very good and effective way.
We've got time for one last caller, Jack in Berkeley. Be brief and to the point, Jack. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, guys. I think we need to call on Ken as a roving philosophical reporter here. He's in Paris. I don't know, Ken, how often you've visited or how long you've been there.
That's John who's in Paris.
I beg your pardon. John that's in Paris, yeah. That I live there 6 months each year, and I invite John to just look around and report to us that they're living in a society where basically everything is funded through taxation and government, very little through philanthropy, and yet when you look around, you see a life that understands that beauty is an essential nutrient to the human soul, where language is an art form, where there's excellent basic universal medical care, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on. So I just want to know, what's John's report?
Well, my report is very much like you say. I've been in France, spent time in France for many, many years. It's a really great place, and there's so much we could adopt from their way of doing things, and we should.
So is that true, that the very little of French public goods are funded through philanthropy? It's all through the tax system?
Actually, it's the amount that's being funded through civil society and through philanthropy is growing, and for the very reasons that we champion it here. That is, there's a feeling that even with all the good things the government provides there, there's a certain amount of negative bureaucracy and so on that's inherently involved in government.
So last quick question. So if we had a well-functioning socialist society, right, where people were taxed and weren't these great disparities of wealth, this is a hypothetical, would we still have the need for civil society and philanthropy, on your view? And why would we still need?
Again, I just go back to Walzer. I think that he stated so beautifully. That is, even in a society, he says, because in a situation where poverty has been abolished, it will still be the case that people experience fear and want, and they need help. And that means there has to be a place for what he and Richard Titmuss, a sociologist, called the gift relationship. And that relies, again, on this voluntary sense of and mutual self-help, not something that is mandated.
Well, that's really interesting, Bruce. This is a fascinating topic. I wish we had more time, but I got to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Bruce Sievers. He's a co-founder of the Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society. He's a visiting scholar at the Haas Center for Public Service, and he's author of Civil Society, Philanthropy, and the Fate of the Commons. So, John, you got any last philanthropical thoughts briefly from Paris for us?
Well, if I had a lot of money, I think I would give some of it away and be glad for the tax break. And if somebody with a lot of money wanted to get a tax break and give me some for some worthwhile purpose, I would probably accept it. So it would be hypocritical of me to be too critical of philanthropy.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me philanthropy is a very good thing. It should be regulated and controlled. But and the pluralism, I mean, Bruce actually really convinced me of things that I wasn't convinced of before. The absolute importance of the non-governmental, non-market sphere of civil society. But you know what, folks? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore, I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
You can also follow us on Twitter. Isn't that exciting? We're at PhilTalk Radio. Now, here's a guy who's got speed to give away. He ended up on third, but he ran there talking all the way. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, philanthropy began as a classical trope indicating a love of and faith in humanity. Aeschylus coined the word in a play about Prometheus, who first gave culture to primitive humans. Well, fire, anyway. In the Middle Ages, love of humanity was superseded by religious equivalents, like charity, exercised more for personal salvation than love of humanity, or so some claim. After a series of religious wars, the New World beckoned. Capitalism was born, the secular reared its head, and civilization as we know it became inundated with societies for the advancement of this, that, and the other, men's clubs, guilds, associations. Philanthropy came to mean a private activity, as opposed to a government or church mandate, that would improve society in some way. And it came to pass that the Gilded Age begat 20th century philanthropy. Take Henry Clay Frick and Andrew Carnegie, steel magnates, labor-squashing titans of industry. Frick was responsible, more or less, for a great melee between Pinkerton agents and protesting workers, resulting in 10 dead. Frick and Carnegie, along with 50-plus other rich dudes, also had a private lake that had been a reservoir. Like so many today, they were not big on infrastructure. The dam broke, and over 2,000 people were killed in the resulting Johnstown flood. Later in life, Frick donated Frick Park to the city of Pittsburgh, and his collection of art is now a museum in New York, containing Fragonards and Van Dykes, purchased with the blood of the working man, or so some claim. Andrew Carnegie, meanwhile, shelled out money for public libraries, over 2,500 of them, including one in my hometown, built in 1904. This is an American thing. Rich guys get rich and do entertaining and or ruthless things with their money, building a vast empire of whatever, leaving a trail of broken lives in their wake along with employment, and, of course, the gleaming empire of whatever, which will exist for 1,000 years, well, 50 or so, before being disrupted, as we now say, by the next Ozymandias. Anyway, we've come to expect our billionaires to do the right thing, though they are under no obligation, really. An opera house, a hospital, the wing of a museum, at least, a symphony, cancer research. Now, lately, philanthropy has been questioned because we're a bunch of busybody fuss budgets with Twitter accounts. The Clinton Foundation was set up to help people meet the global challenge of economic interdependence. This means earthquake relief and microloans, the latest philanthropical buzzword. But does it also mean the Clintons are grifters, scamming the world out of its hard-earned dollars? So some claim. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the largest private foundation in the world, gives us warm fuzzies, but its education arm is too agenda-driven, specifically anti-union and pro-chartered school. It does more harm than good, so some claim. And it's hard now to tell the difference between acts of philanthropy and capitalism. It's the sharing economy, isn't it? Sharing is good. Disruption makes things better. We're all cab drivers now. Every home is a hotel. And there's billionaire Peter Thiel so mad at the online yellow journalism thingy Gawker because of things Gawker had written about him that he funded a suit against Gawker from wrestler Hulk Hogan, which has wound up forcing Gawker into bankruptcy. Take that, snarky gossip blog. That was an act of philanthropy, or its modern equivalent, so some claim. Well, some thought Trump University was a real school, too. Caveat emptor. And also beware of thin-skinned libertarians bearing gifts. This week's Gawker could be next week's Washington Post, which was bought by Amazon's Jeff Bezos as an act of charity. Or so some claim. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topete, and Ted Muldoon.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, local public radio, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I'm the only one in the world could raise almost $6 million for the veterans, have uniform applause by the veterans groups, and end up being criticized by the press.